Joan, he said sharply. You can't lug great flowers about. You've got to carry a bag. Hurry up now. Your mother'll have tea waiting. Homily was there at the last gate to meet them. She had tidied her hair and smelled of soap. Well, she kept saying. Well, taking the bag from Arietti. Well? Was it nice? Were you a good girl? Was the cherry tree out? Did the clock strike? She seemed to be trying to read the expression on Arietti's face. Come along now. Tea's all ready. Tea was indeed ready. Laid on the round table in the sitting room, with a bright fire burning in the cog wheel. How familiar the room seemed, and homely. But suddenly, how strange. The firelight flickering on the wallpaper, the line which read, It would be so charming if... If what? Arietti always wondered. If our house were less dark, she thought, that would be charming. She looked at the old teapot, a hollow oak apple, with its quill spout and wired-on handle. There were two roast-sliced chestnuts, which they would eat like toast with butter, and in front of each place, oh, delight of delights, a single potted shrimp. Well, said Homily, pouring. Tell us what you saw. She didn't see so much, said Pod, cutting himself a slice of chestnut to eat with his shrimp. Didn't she see the overmantel? No, said Pod. We never went in the morning room. What about my blotting paper? I never got it, said Pod. Now that's a nice thing, began Homily. Maybe, said Pod, but I had me feeling. I had it bad. What's that? Asked Arietti. His feeling. Up the back of his head and in his fingers, said Homily. It's a feeling your father gets when... She dropped her voice. There's something about. Oh, said Arietti, and seemed to shrink. That's why I brought her along home, said Pod. And was there anyone? Asked Homily anxiously. Pod took a mouthful of shrimp. Must have been, but I didn't see nothing. Homily leaned across the table. Did you have any feeling, Arietti? Arietti started. Oh, she said. Do we all have it? Well, not in the same place, said Homily. Mine starts at the back of my ankles and then my knees go. Arietti moistened her lips. She glanced nervously from Pod to Homily. I didn't feel anything, she said. Well, said Homily, perhaps it was a false alarm. Oh, no, began Arietti. It wasn't, and as Homily glanced at her sharply, she faltered. I mean, if Papa felt something, I mean, perhaps I don't have it. Well, said Homily, you're young. You go and stand in our kitchen just under the chute when Mrs. Driver's raking out the stove upstairs. Stand right up on a stool or something so you're fairly near the ceiling. It'll come with practice. After tea, Arietti rushed to her diary. I'll just open it, she thought, anywhere. It fell open at July 9th and 10th. Talk of camps, but stay at home. Old Cameronian colours in Glasgow Cathedral, 1885. That's what it said for the 9th. And on the 10th, the page was headed, Make Hay While the Sun Shines, Snowdon Peak, sold for £5,750, 1889. Arietti tore out this last page, and crossing out her last entry, Mother Out of Sorts, she wrote below it, Dear Uncle Hendreary, I hope you are quite well, and the cousins are well, and Aunt Luppy. We are all well, and I am learning to borrow. Your loving niece, Arietti Clock. P.S. Write a letter on the back, please. Arietti folded the letter and placed it carefully between the pages of Bryce's Tom Thumb Gazetteer of the World, and in the diary she wrote, Went borrowing. Wrote to H. Talked to B. After that, Arietti sat for a long time staring into the fire and thinking. And thinking and thinking. But it was one thing to write a letter, and quite another to find some means of getting it under the mat. Pod could not be persuaded to go borrowing. He was well away on his yearly turnout of the storerooms. Arietti usually enjoyed this spring sorting. She used to love turning over the scraps of silk or lace, the hairpins and the needles, the dried figs, the hazelnuts, and the scarlet stubs of sealing wax. But this year, Arietti banged about impatiently and stole away whenever she dared, to stare through the grating, hoping to see the boy. She kept the letter always with her, stuffed inside her jersey. Once he did run past the grating. He was making a chugging noise in his throat like some kind of engine, and as he turned the corner, he let out a piercing woo-woo, so he did not hear her call. Homily, every time she swept the sitting room, would grumble about the carpet. "It may be a curtain and chair job," she would say to Pod, "but it wouldn't take you not a quarter of an hour to fetch me a bit of blotting paper from the desk in the morning room." And at last, on the fourth day, Pod gave in. He laid down his hammer, a small electric bell clapper, and said to Arietti, "Come along." Arietti was glad to see the morning room. It was fascinating to stand at last in the thick pile of carpet, gazing up at the shelves and pillars and towering gables of the famous overmantel. So that's where they had lived, she thought, those pleasure-loving creatures, remote and gay. She imagined the overmantel women, with wasp waists and piled Edwardian hair, swinging carelessly outwards on the pilasters, lissome and laughing. She imagined the overmantel men, fair they were said to be, with long moustaches and nervous, slender hands, smoking and drinking and telling their witty tales. And they had lived only on breakfast food, on toast and eggs and tiny snips of mushroom. Sausage they'd have had, and crispy bacon, and little sips of tea and coffee. Where are they now? Arietti wondered. Where could such creatures go? Pod had flung his pin so that it stuck in the seat of the chair, and was up the leg in a trice, leaning outwards on his tape. Then, pulling out the pin, he flung it like a javelin above his head into a fold of curtain. This is the moment, Arietti thought, and felt for her precious letter. She slipped into the hall and ran across it with a beating heart. The mat was heavy, but she lifted up the corner and slid the letter under by pushing with her foot. There, she said, and looked about her. Shadows. Shadows and the ticking clock. She looked across the great plain of floor to where, in the distance, the stairs mounted. Another world above, she thought. World on world. And shivered slightly. Arietti, Pod called softly from the morning room, and she rang back in time to see him swing clear of the chair seat and pull himself upwards, level with the desk. Lightly, he came down, feet apart. The blotting paper, when he pushed it, floated down quite softly and lay pink and fresh on the carpet's dingy pile. "You start rolling," whispered Pod. "I'll be down." And Arietti went on her knees and began to roll the blotting paper. Pod finished it off and lashed it with his name tape, through which he ran his hatpin, and together they carried the long cylinder, as two house painters would carry a ladder, under the clock and down the hole. Homily hardly thanked them when, panting a little, they dropped the bundle in the passage outside the sitting-room door. She looked alarmed. "Oh, there you are, thank goodness! That boy's about again! I've just heard Mrs. Driver talking to Cramp Furl." "Oh," cried Arietti. "What did she say?" And Homily glanced sharply at her. Arietti realized she should have said, "What boy?" But it was too late now. "Nothing real bad," Homily went on. "It's just a boy they have upstairs. But I heard Mrs. Driver say that she'd take a slipper to him if he had the mats up once again in the hall." "The mats up in the hall?" echoed Arietti. "Yes. 3 days running," she said to Cramp Furl. "What's the matter, Arietti? There's no call for that sort of face. Come on now, help me move the furniture and we'll get down the carpet." Oh dear, thought Arietti miserably. 3 days running, he's looked and nothing there. He'll give up hope now. He'll never look again. That evening, she stood for hours on a stool under the chute in their kitchen, pretending she was practicing to get a feeling, when really she was listening to Mrs. Driver's conversations with Crampfurl. All she learned was that Mrs. Driver's feet were killing her, and would Crampfurl have another drop, considering there was more in the cellar than anyone would drink in her lifetime. But on the third night, just as Arietti had climbed down off the stool, she heard Crampfurl say,
"If you ask me, I'd say he had a ferret."
And quickly, Arietti climbed back again.
"A ferret?" she heard Mrs. Driver exclaim shrilly. "Whatever next? Where would he keep it?" "Well, that I wouldn't like to say," said Crampfurl in his rumbling, earthy voice. "All I know is he was up beyond Parkins Beck, going round all the banks and calling down all the rabbit holes."
"Well, I never," said Mrs. Driver.
"Yes," Crampfurl went on. "When he saw me coming with a gun, he pretended to be cutting a stick light from the edge. But I'd seed him all right, and heard him, calling away, his nose down a rabbit hole. It's my belief he's got a ferret. Yes, a ferret called Uncle something."
Arietti made a sharp movement, balanced for one moment with arms waving, and fell off the stool. There was a clatter as the stool slid sideways and rolled over.
"What was that?" asked Crampfurl.
Arietti held her breath.
"I didn't hear nothing," said Mrs. Driver. "Yes," said Crampfurl. "It was under the floor light there by the stove." "That's nothing," said Mrs. Driver. "It's the coals falling. Often sounds like that. Scares you sometimes when you're sitting here alone. Here, pass your glass. There's only drop left. Might as well finish the bottle."
"They're drinking fine old Madeira," thought Arietti, and very carefully she set the stool upright and stood quietly beside it looking up. She could see light through the crack, occasionally flicked with shadow as one person or another moved a hand or arm.
"Yes," went on Crampfurl, "and when I came up with my gun, he says, all innocent like, 'Any old badgers sets round here?'"
"Artful," said Mrs. Driver. "The things they think of, badgers sets." And she gave her creaking laugh.
"As a matter of fact," said Crampfurl, "there did used to be one. But when I showed him where it was like, he didn't take no notice of it. Just stood there, waiting for me to go."
Crampfurl laughed.
"Two can play at that game, I thought, so I sits myself down. And there we were, the two of us."
"And what happened?"
"Well, he had to go in the end, leaving his ferret. I waited a bit, but he never came out. I poked about a bit and whistled. Pity I never heard properly what he called it. Uncle something, it sounded like."
Arietti heard the sudden scrape of a chair.
"Well, I better go now and shut up the chickens."
The scullery door banged, and there was a clatter overhead as Mrs. Driver began to rake the stove. Arietti replaced the stool and stole softly into the sitting room, where she found her mother alone. Homily was ironing, bending and banging and pushing the hair back out of her eyes. All round the room, underclothes hung airing on safety pins, which Homily used like coat hangers.
"What happened?" asked Homily. "Did you fall over?"
Yes, said Arietti, moving quietly into her place beside the fire.
"How's the feeling come in?"
"Oh, I don't know," said Arietti. She clasped her knees and laid her chin on them.
"Where's your knitting?" asked Homily. "I don't know what's come over you lately. Always idle. You don't feel seedy, do you?"
"Oh!" exclaimed Arietti. "Let me be!" And Homily, for once, was silent.
"It's the spring," she told herself. "You used to take me like that sometimes at her age." "I must see that boy," Arietti was thinking, staring blindly into the fire. "I must see what happened. I must hear if they're all right. I don't want us to die out. I don't want to be the last of the borrowers. I don't want..." And here Arietti dropped her face onto her knees. "To live forever and ever like this, in the dark, under the floor."
"No good getting supper," said Homily, breaking the silence. "Your father's gone borrowing.
to her room. And you know what that means.
Arietti raised her head.
No, she said, hardly listening. What does it mean?
That he won't be back, said Homily sharply, for a good hour and a half. He likes it up there, gossiping with her, and poking about on the dressing table. And it's safe enough once that boy's in bed.
Arietti was suddenly sitting bolt upright. A thought had struck her, leaving her breathless and a little shaky at the knees.
A good hour and a half, her mother had said, and the gates would be open.
Where are you going?
Asked Homily, as Arietti moved towards the door.
Just along to the storerooms, said Arietti. It won't be long.
As Arietti went down the passage, she thought,
It is true. I am going to the storerooms to find another hatpin. And if I do find a hatpin and a piece of string, there won't be any more name tape. I still won't be long, because I'll have to get back before Papa, and I'm doing it for their sakes, and one day they'll thank me.
All the same, she felt a little guilty. Artful. That's what Mrs. Driver would have said she was. There was a hatpin, and she tied on a piece of string very firmly, twisting it back and forth like a figure of eight. The gates were open. The great hall, when she climbed out into it, was dim with shadows. A single gas jet turned low made a pool of light beside the locked front door, and another faintly flickered on the landing halfway up the stairs. The ceiling sprang away into height and darkness, and all around was space. Arietti had watched her father use his pin on the chair, and single stairs in comparison were easier. There was a kind of rhythm to it, a throw, a pull, a scramble, and an upward swing. The stair rods glinted coldly, but the pile of the carpet seemed soft and warm and delicious to fall back on. She did not mind the semi-darkness. She lived in darkness, and at a time like this, it made her feel safe. On the upper landing, she saw an open door, and a great square of golden light which, like a barrier, lay across the passage. Inside the lighted room, a voice was talking, droning on.
And this mare was a five-year-old which really belonged to my brother in Ireland, the one who owns Stalemate and Oh My Darling. He had entered her for several point-to-points. Have you ever seen an Irish point-to-point?
No, said another voice, rather absent-mindedly.
That's my father,
Arietti realized with a start.
My father talking to Great-Aunt Sophie, or rather Great-Aunt Sophie talking to my father.
She gripped her pin with its loops of string and ran into the light and threw it to the passage beyond. As she passed the open door, she had a glimpse of firelight and lamplight and gleaming furniture and dark red silk brocade. Beyond the square of light, the passage was dark again, and she could see at the far end a half-open door.
That's the day nursery, she thought, and beyond that is the night nursery.
There are certain differences, Aunt Sophie's voice went on, which would strike you at once.
For instance, Arietti liked the voice. It was comforting and steady, like the sound of the clock in the hall.
And as she moved off the carpet onto the strip of polished floor beside the skirting board, she was interested to hear that there were walls in Ireland instead of hedges. Here, by the skirting, she could run, and she loved running. Carpets were heavy going. The boards were smooth and smelled of beeswax. She liked the smell. The schoolroom, when she reached it, was shrouded in dust sheets and full of junk. Here, too, a gas jet burned, turned low to a bluish flame. She looked up and saw the corner cupboard with the doll's tea service and the plush curtains where her father had been seen. Chair legs were everywhere. She found her way among them to the door of the night nursery, and there she saw, on a shadowed plateau in the far corner, the boy in bed. She saw his great face turned towards her on the edge of the pillow. She saw the gaslight reflected in his open eyes. She saw his hand gripping the bedclothes, holding them tightly pressed against his mouth. She stood still. After a while, when she saw his fingers relax, she said softly,
"Don't be frightened. It's me, Arietti."
He let the bedclothes slide away from his mouth and said,
"Ari what?"
He seemed annoyed.
"Etty," she repeated gently. "Did you take the letter?"
He stared at her for a moment without speaking. Then he said,
"Why did you come creeping into my room?" "I didn't come creeping, said Arietti. "I even ran, didn't you see?"
He was silent, staring at her with his great wide-open eyes.
"When I brought the book," he said at last, "you'd gone."
"I had to go. Tea was ready. My father fetched me." He understood this.
"Oh," he said, matter-of-factly.
"Did you take the letter?" she asked again.
"Yes," he said. "I had to go back twice. I shoved it down the badger's hole."
Suddenly, he threw back the bedclothes and stood up in bed, enormous in his pale flannel nightshirt. It was Arietti's turn to be afraid. She half-turned, her eyes on his face, and began backing towards the door. But he did not look at her. He was feeling behind a picture on the wall.
"Here it is," he said, sitting down again, and the bed creaked loudly. "But I don't want it back," exclaimed Arietti. "You should have left it there. Why did you bring it back?"
He turned it over in his fingers.
"He's written on it," he said. "Oh, please," cried Arietti excitedly. "Show me." She ran right up to the bed and tugged at the trailing sheet. "Then they are alive. Did you see him?"
"No," he said. "The letter was there, just down the hall where I put it."
He leaned towards her.
"But he's written on it. Look."
She made a quick dart and almost snatched the letter out of his great fingers. She ran with it to the door of the schoolroom, where the light, though dim, was a little brighter.
"It's very faint," she said, holding it close to her eyes. "What's he written it with, I wonder? It's all in capitals."
She turned suddenly.
"Are you sure you didn't write it?"
"Of course not," he began. "I write small."
But she had seen by his face that he spoke the truth, and began to spell out the letters.
"T-E-double-L," she said. "Tell."
"Y-O-R-E,"
she looked up.
"Your,"
she said.
"Yes," said the boy.
"Your."
"Tell your A-N-T.
"Aunt," said Arietti.
"Aunt? My aunt?"
The boy was silent, waiting.
"Aunt L-U..."
"Oh, Aunt Luppy," she exclaimed. "He says, listen, this is what he says. Tell your Aunt Luppy to come home."
"Well, then tell her," said the boy after a moment.
"But she isn't here," exclaimed Arietti. "She's never been here. I don't even remember what she looked like."
"Look," said the boy, staring through the door. "Someone's coming." Arietti whipped round. There was no time to hide. It was Pod, borrowing bag in one hand, pin in the other. He stood in the doorway of the schoolroom. Quite still, he stood, outlined against the light in the passage. He had seen her.
"I heard your voice," he said. And there was a dreadful quietness about the way he spoke. "Just as I was coming out of her room."
Arietti stared back at him, stuffing the letter up her jumper. Could he see beyond her into the shadowed room? Could he see the tousled shape in bed?
"Come on home," said Pod, and turned away.
Pod did not speak until they reached the sitting room, nor did he look at her. He had ignored her efforts to help him shut the gates, but once when she tripped, he had waited until she got up again, watching her, it seemed, almost without interest while she brushed the dust off her knees. Supper was laid, and the ironing put away, and Homily came running in from the kitchen, surprised to see them together. Pod threw down his borrowing bag. He stared at his wife.
What's the matter? Faltered Homily, looking from one to the other.
She was in the night nursery, said Pod quietly, talking to that boy.
Homily moved forward, her hands clasped tremblingly against her apron.
Oh, no, she breathed.
Pod sat down. His face looked heavy like a piece of dough.
Now what? He said.
Homily stood quite still and stared at Arietti.
Oh, you never, she whispered. They are frightened, Arietti realized. They're not angry at all. They are very, very frightened.
She moved forward.
It's all right, she began.
Homily sat down suddenly on the cotton reel. She had begun to tremble.
Oh, she said, whatever shall we do?
And she began to rock herself to and fro.
Oh, Mother, don't, pleaded Arietti. It isn't so bad as that. It really isn't.
She felt up the front of her jersey.
Look, she said. Here's a letter from Uncle Hendreary. I wrote to him and the boy took the letter.
You wrote to him? Cried Homily.
Oh, she moaned. Whatever next? Whatever shall we do?
And she fanned herself limply with her bony hand.
Get your mother a drink of water, said Pod sharply.
Arietti brought it in a sawn-off hazel shell shaped like a brandy glass.
Oh, but whatever made you do such a thing, said Homily more calmly. Whatever came over you?
So Arietti told them about being seen that morning under the cherry tree, and what the boy had said about dying out, and how, more than important, how imperative it had seemed to make sure the Hendrearys were alive.
Please understand, pleaded Arietti. I'm trying to save the race.
The expressions she uses, said Homily to Pod, not without pride. But Pod was not listening. Save the race, he repeated grimly. It's people like you, my girl, who do things sudden-like with no respect for tradition, who'll finish us borrowers once and for all.
Do you see what you've done?
Arietti met his accusing eyes.
Yes, she said, falteringly. I've got in touch with the only ones still alive. So that, she went on bravely, from now on we can all stick together.
All stick together, Pod repeated angrily. Do you think Hendreary's lot would ever come to live back here? Can you see your mother emigrating to a badger set 2 fields away, out in the open and no hot water laid on? Never, cried Homily, in a full, rich voice, which made both of them turn and look at her. But wait, Pod said, as Arietti tried to speak. That's not the point.
As far as all that goes, we're just where we was. The point, he went on, leaning forward and speaking with great solemnity, is this.
The boy knows now where we live.
Oh, no, said Arietti. I never told him that.
You told him, interrupted Pod. About the kitchen pipe bursting? You told him about how all our stuff got washed away to the grating?
He sat back again, glaring at her.
He's only got to think, he pointed out.
Arietti was silent, and Pod went on.
That's a thing that has never happened before, never, in the whole long history of the borrowers. Borrowers have been seen, yes. Borrowers have been caught, maybe. But no human being has ever known where any borrower lived. We are in grave danger, Arietti, and you've put us there.
Oh, Pod, whimpered Homily, don't frighten the child.
Nay, Homily, Pod said more gently. My poor old girl, I don't want to frighten no one. But suppose I said to you, pack up tonight, all our bits and pieces. Where would you go?
Not to Hendreary's, cried Homily. Not there, Pod. I couldn't never share a kitchen with Luppy.
No, agreed Pod. Not to Hendreary's. And don't you see for why? The boy knows about that, too. A couple of terriers or a well-trained ferret, and that'd be the end of that lot.
Oh, Pod, said Homily, and began again to tremble. And I dare say I could have got it nice in the end, providing we lived quite separate.
Well, there's no good thinking of it now.
Pod turned to Arietti.
What does your Uncle Hendreary say in his letter?
It doesn't say much, said Arietti, passing over the paper. It just says, tell your Aunt Lippy to come home.
What? Exclaimed Homily. Come home? What can he mean?
He means, said Pod, the Luppy must have set off to come here and that she never arrived.
But something must have happened to her, exclaimed Homily.
Yes, said Pod.
He turned to Arietti. See what I mean about those fields?
Pod, said Homily soberly, I'm frightened. Everything seems to be happening at once. What are we going to do?
Well, said Pod. There's nothing we can do tonight but have a bit of supper and a good night's rest.
Oh, Arietti, wailed Homily. You naughty, wicked girl. How could you go and start all this? How could you go and talk to a human being? If only I was seen, cried Arietti. I couldn't help being seen. Papa was seen. I don't think it's all as awful as you're trying to make out. I don't think human beings are all that bad.
They're bad and they're good, said Pod. They're honest and they're artful. It's just as it takes them at the moment. And animals, if they could talk, would say the same. Steer clear of them. No good never really came to no one from a human being.
That night, while Arietti lay straight and still under her cigar box ceiling, Homily and Pod talked for hours. She heard drawers shutting and opening, doors creaking, and boxes being pulled out from under beds.
What are they doing? She wondered. What will happen next?
Very still, she lay in her soft little bed with her familiar belongings about her. Her postage stamp view of Rio Harbour, her silver pig off a charm bracelet, her turquoise ring, which sometimes for fun she would wear as a crown, and dearest of all, her floating ladies with the golden trumpets. She did not want to lose these, she realized, but to have all the other things as well. Adventure and safety mixed, that's what she wanted. And that, the restless bangings and whisperings told her, is just what you couldn't do. As it happened, Homily was only fidgeting, opening drawers and shutting them, unable to be still. And she ended up, when Pod was already in bed, by deciding to curl her hair.
Now, Homily, Pod protested, there's really no call for that. Who's going to see you?
That's just it, exclaimed Homily. In times like these, one never knows.
She came to bed at last, looking spiky. And Pod, with a sigh, turned over and closed his eyes. Homily lay for a long time staring at the oil lamp. It was the silver cap off a scent bottle, with a tiny floating wick. She felt unwilling for some reason to blow it out. She gazed, just as Arietti had done, about the familiar room. Too full, she realized, with little bags and boxes and makeshift cupboards, and thought, what now? Perhaps nothing will happen after all. The child perhaps is right. This boy is only a guest. Perhaps he'll go away quite soon, and that, she told herself drowsily,
will be that.
Later, as she realized afterwards, she must have dozed off, because it seemed she was crossing Parkin's Beck. It was night, and the wind was blowing. The trees were threshing and clashing, their branches waving and soaring against the sky. Then there was the sound of splintering wood. And Homily woke up. She saw the room again, and the oil lamp flickering, but something she knew at once was different. There was a strange draught, and her mouth felt dry and full of grit. Then she looked up at the ceiling.
"Pod!"
she shrieked, clutching his shoulder. Pod rolled over and sat up. They both stared at the ceiling. The whole surface was on a steep slant, and one side of it had come right away from the wall and down into the room to within an inch of the foot of the bed, protruded a huge bar of grey steel with a flattened, shining edge.
"It's a screwdriver," said Pod.
They stared at it, fascinated, unable to move. Then slowly the huge object swayed upwards until the sharp edge lay against their ceiling, and Homily heard a scrape on the floor above and a human gasp.
"Oh, my knees," cried Homily. "Oh, my feeling."
As with a splintering wrench, their whole roof flew off and fell down with a clatter somewhere out of sight. Homily screamed then, a real scream, loud and shrill and hearty, while her eyes stared up, half interested, into empty, lighted space. There was another ceiling, away up above them, higher, it seemed, than the sky. A ham hung from it, and two strings of onions. Arietti appeared in the doorway, scared and trembling, and Pod slapped Homily's back. "Have done," he said. "That's enough." And Homily suddenly was quiet. A great face appeared then, between them and that distant height. It wavered above them, smiling and terrible. "Is that your mother?" asked a surprised voice. And Arietti whispered, "Yes." It was the boy. Pod got out of bed and stood beside it, shivering.
"Come on," he said to Homily. "You can't stay there."
But Homily could. She had her old nightdress on with the patch in the back, and nothing was going to move her. A slow anger was rising up in Homily. She had been caught in her hair curlers. Pod had raised his hand to her, and she remembered that in the general turmoil, she had left the washing up for the morning, and there it would be for all the world to see. She glared at the boy. He was only a child, after all.
"Put it back," she said. "Put it back at once."
Her eyes flashed, and her curlers seemed to quiver. He knelt down then, but Homily did not flinch as the great face came slowly closer.
"But I've got something for you," he said. And Arietti called out, "What have you got?"
The boy reached behind him, and very gingerly, careful to keep it upright, he held a wooden object above their heads.
"It's this," he said,
and lowered the object into their hole. It was a doll's dresser, complete with plates. Arietti ran round to see better.
"Oh," she said ecstatically, "Mother, look!"
Homily threw the dresser a glance. It was dark oak, and the plates were hand-painted. And then she looked quickly away again. "Yes," she said coldly. "It's very nice."
"There, Homily," Pod said placatingly. "You've always wanted something like that."
"Yes," said Homily, her hands clasped in her lap. "Thank you very much. And now, will you please put back the roof?"
"Well, wait a minute," pleaded the boy.
Again he reached behind him. Again the hand came down. And there, beside the dresser, was a very small doll's chair. It was a Victorian chair, upholstered in red velvet.
"Oh!"
Arietti exclaimed again. And Pod said shyly,
"Just about fit me, that would."
"Try it," begged the boy. "Go on," said Arietti.
And Pod sat down, in his nightshirt, his bare feet showing.
"That's nice," he said, after a moment.
"It would go by the fire in the sitting room," cried Arietti. It would look lovely on red blotting paper.
Let's try it, said the boy, and the hand came down again. Pod sprang up just in time as the red velvet chair was whisked away.
Arietti ran out of the door and along the passage to see.
Oh, she called out to her parents, come and see, it's lovely.
But Pod and Homily did not move. The boy was leaning over them, breathing hard. He seemed to be examining the father room.
What do you keep in that mustard pot? He asked.
Coal, said Arietti's voice. And here's the watch I told you about, and the pictures.
I could get you some better stamps than those, the boy said. I've got some Jubilee ones with the Taj Mahal.
Look, cried Arietti's voice again, and Pod took Homily's hand. These are my books.
What are they called? The boy asked,
and Arietti reeled off the names.
Pod, whispered Homily. I'm going to scream.
No, whispered Pod. You mustn't. Not again.
I feel it coming on, said Homily.
Pod looked worried.
Hold your breath, he said, and count to 10.
The boy was saying to Arietti,
why couldn't you read me those?
Well, I could, said Arietti, but I'd rather read something new.
But you never come, complained the boy.
I know, said Arietti, but I will.
Pod, whispered Homily. Did you hear what she said?
Yes, yes, Pod whispered. He looked up at the boy.
Hey, he called. The boy looked down. Put the roof back now, Pod begged him, trying to sound reasonable. We're getting cold.
All right, agreed the boy, but he seemed to hesitate. He reached across them for the piece of board that formed their roof.
Shall I nail you down? He asked, and they saw him pick up the hammer. It swayed above them, very dangerous-looking.
Of course nail us down, said Pod irritably. I mean, said the boy, I've got some more things upstairs.
Pod looked uncertain, and Homily nudged him.
Ask him, she whispered, what kind of things?
What kind of things? Asked Pod.
Things from an old doll's house on the top shelf of the cupboard in the schoolroom. Carpets and rugs and beds with mattresses. And there's a bird in a cage, not a real one, of course, and cooking pans and tables and 5 gilt chairs.
Homily leaned across to Pod.
Tell him to nail us down lightly.
Pod turned to the boy.
All right, he said. You can nail us down, but lightly, if you see what I mean. Just a tap or two here and there.
Then began a curious phase in their lives. Borrowing beyond all dreams of borrowing. A golden age. Every night, the floor was opened and treasures would appear. A real carpet for the sitting room. A tiny coal scuttle. A stiff little sofa with damask cushions, framed pictures instead of stamps. There was a little desk with one drawer and a bureau with curved legs. Homily grew not only accustomed to the roof coming off, but even went so far as to suggest to Pod that he put the board on hinges.
It's just the hammerings I don't care for, she explained. It brings down the dirt.
When the boy brought them a grand piano, Homily begged Pod to build them a drawing room.
Then we could have those gilt chairs he talks about, she said, and the palm in a pot.
Pod, however, was a little tired of furniture removing. He was looking forward to the quiet evenings when he could doze at last beside the fire in his new velvet chair. No sooner had he put a chest of drawers in one place when Homily made him try it somewhere else. And every evening, at about his usual bedtime, the roof would fly up and more stuff would arrive. But Homily was tireless. Bright-eyed and pink-cheeked, after a long day's pushing and pulling, she still would leave nothing until morning.
Let's just try it, she would beg. It won't take a minute.
But as Pod well knew, it would be several hours before, dishevelled and aching, they finally dropped into bed.
In the meantime, in payment for these riches, Arietti would read to the boy. Every afternoon in the long grass beside the cherry tree, he would lie on his back, and she would stand by his shoulder and tell him when to turn a page. They were happy days to look back on afterwards, with the blue sky beyond the cherry boughs, the grasses softly stirring, and the boy's great ear listening beside her. He was very still while she read to him, and always grateful. What worlds they would explore together! Strange worlds to Arietti. She was made to realize once and for all that this earth on which they lived, turning in space, did not revolve as she had believed for the sake of little people. Nor for big people either, she reminded the boy when she saw his secret smile. In the cool of the evening, Pod would come for her to take her back for tea, and at home there would be fresh delights to discover. "Shut your eyes," Homily would cry. "Now open them." And Arietti, in a dream of joy, would see her home transformed. All kinds of surprises there were. Even one day, lace curtains at the grating, looped up with pink string. Yes, they were happy days. And all would have been well, as Pod said afterwards, if they had stuck to borrowing from the doll's house. No one in the human household seemed to remember it was there, and consequently nothing was missed. The drawing-room, however, could not help but be a temptation, and the boy, of course, could turn the key in the glass doors of the cabinet. The silver violin he brought them first, and then the silver harp. "A musical conversazione, that's what we could have!" cried the exulting Homily. "If only your father would start on the drawing-room! There are quite enough of those builder's bricks to make a parquet floor." "Parquet," she would say, "parquet," just like a harpsichord. Even Great-Aunt Sophie, right away in the littered grandeur of her bedroom, seemed distantly affected by a spirit of endeavour which seemed to flow, in gleeful whirls and eddies about the staid old house. Several times lately, Pod had found her out of bed. He went there nowadays not to borrow, but to get away from things. Pod was a little irked by his riches. He had never visualized borrowing such as this, these jeweled snuff-boxes and diamond-encrusted miniatures, all from the drawing-room, were not really necessary. What was the good of a shepherdess nearly as tall as Arietti? He watched Aunt Sophie hobble round the room on her two sticks. "She'll be downstairs soon, I shouldn't wonder," he thought glumly. "Then she'll miss these things." It was not Aunt Sophie, however, who missed them first. It was Mrs. Driver. Mrs. Driver had never forgotten the trouble over Rosa Pickhatchet. It had not been at the time easy to pinpoint the guilt. "From now on," Mrs. Driver had said, "I'll manage on me own. No more strange maids in this house." A drop of Madeira here, a pair of stockings there, these, Mrs. Driver felt, were different. But trinkets out of the drawing-room cabinet, that was a different story altogether. Standing there in the spring sunshine, feather duster in hand, she felt tricked. It was as though someone, suspecting her dishonesty, were trying to catch her out. But who could it be? Crampfurl? That boy? Could it, she wondered suddenly, be the mistress herself? That old girl had been out of bed lately. Might she not have come downstairs in the night, snooping and spying? Mrs. Driver remembered the empty Madeira bottle and the two glasses which so often were left on the kitchen table. Was not this just the sort of thing she might do? Watching and waiting for Mrs. Driver to report.